Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And today we are going to talk about storm chasers and what they do and the technology they use to do their jobs. And just so you guys know, a couple of things we want to get out of the way. First of all, we're recording this while there's an actual storm going on outside the office. This isn't a joke.
Hopefully not a tornado-involving storm.
Yeah,
but
we
if
hope
you hear
not.
Some thunder in the background, it's atmospheric.
Yeah, we didn't actually add it in post. It's really happening right now. So just so you guys know that. And the second thing we want to mention is we're going to be talking a lot about storm chasing in general. This is our warning, which we will be repeating at the end of the episode. Storm chasing is seriously dangerous business.
This is not a hobbyist thing.
Though some people treat it that way, it is you are putting yourself at serious risk when you are encountering major storm fronts, including but not limited to tornadoes. So we want to get that out of the way.
And the people who go about storm chasing are professionals. They are researchers. They have been trained, and they do serious work. It's not just all about the thrill. I'm sure that part of it for these people is the thrill, but the number of tornadoes in the United States has increased since the 1960s, but the number of deaths in the U.S. has declined due to these brave people's work.
Right. So. We're learning more about these systems and how to predict them. Now, granted, prediction is about all we can do because these are major storm systems that
we still don't understand
and they
entirely.
Have so much energy. I mean, the energy in these storm systems rivals that of a nuclear bomb.
They can reach above 300 miles an hour.
Yeah, this is serious business. So let's talk a little bit about what storm chasers are and what they do. So they do tend to fall into three major categories. You've got your scientific researchers, which I would say are probably the majority of, well, until recently anyway, were the majority of storm chasers.
Mm-hmm.
These are the men and women who dedicate their lives to studying storm systems, gathering data, and trying to learn everything we can about them so that our forecast models get more and more precise, so that we can increase the levels of safety, not just of where we build things, but how we build them and how to get people out of harm's way. So that's one group. Another group are professionals who are trying to capture video or still images of storms and then sell them to either a news outlet or a magazine or television show or just to any other type of customer. So they're trying to turn storm chasing into profit. And then your third category are your thrill seekers, mm-hmm. who are treating it like a hobby. They want to witness the awesome power of a storm, which can be really amazing to behold, but it is so dangerous.
Yeah. I would say that really technically most storm chasers fall into all three categories in some way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, it's
that's true. It is
a business, and most of them do take footage while they're in them. Most of them are also doing research and are probably excited about.
Right. You've got some hobbyists who are just trying to see a really cool storm, and you've got some companies that are operating tourism where it's actually, they're creating a business where they're taking people out on tours to try and see one of these storms. It's not necessarily that you only belong to one category. You might span multiple categories, but that's generally how folks kind of classify them. Now, really, when it comes down to it, we need to talk about what is an actual tornado, because that's mainly what storm chasers are concerned with. They also will take a look into huge thunderstorm systems, supercells, things mm-hmm. like that. They'll also, some storm chasers will have some experience with things like hurricanes, which are different from tornadoes.
Yeah, it is kind of implied that hurricane chasers are not really storm chasers because you're not so much chasing a hurricane. You know where it is.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, yeah. Hurricanes are very different from tornadoes. Tornadoes are, like we said, they are pretty mysterious. We don't understand fully how they form, what it is that's making them form, or why they form in one set of circumstances, but in another set that seems identical, they don't.
Right.
So that means there's probably some other factors there that we just aren't really completely aware of that create some randomness in this event, which would cause them to form in one case and not in another. So I guess we need to kind of define what a tornado is.
Okay. Well, so it's a swirling mass of air.
Yep.
It is spawned from a series of severe thunderstorms called mm-hmm. supercells, mm-hmm. which are storm clouds that can reach like 6 miles up into the atmosphere.
Yeah. These are tall, tall cloud systems.
Mm-hmm. And it has enough energy to create a cyclone of spinning air.
Right. Now, if we want to go into an even more in-depth definition, the glossary of meteorology says that it's a violently rotating column of air pendant from a cumuliform cloud or underneath a cumuliform cloud, and often but not always visible as a funnel cloud. So literally, in order for a vortex to be classified as a tornado, it must actually be in contact with the ground.
Right.
And
otherwise,
the cloud
otherwise it is just a funnel.
Right. Yeah. So it has to be in contact with the ground. It has to be from the ground all the way up to the cloud base. If it's mm-hmm. not all the way up to the cloud base, it could be what is called a gustnado, or, you know, some people call them, like, you know, even little dust storms, you'll see like a little twisting motion.
Sure.
Those are not actually tornadoes unless they extend all the way up to the cloud base. So it has to be from the cloud base to the ground for it to actually be a tornado.
Usually within a tornado, you've got wind shear going on. That's winds at different altitudes that are blowing in different directions mm-hmm. that end up, you know, creating this rotation.
Yeah, and the rotation in the northern hemisphere tends to be counterclockwise.
Yes.
And in the southern hemisphere, it tends to be clockwise, but that's not a hard and fast rule.
Right.
You can actually have both.
The same way that you can technically in the northern hemisphere see water go down the drain.
Yeah. The Coriolanus effect is one of those things that a lot of people will cite when it comes to this sort of stuff. That really applies to huge bodies, not tiny ones, but in this relatively tiny ones, I should say.
Right.
But in this case, you can actually find storm systems that have both counterclockwise and clockwise moving tornadoes within one system. So it's not like a hard and fast rule. It's just more of a tendency. So there's also this thing called a mesocyclone. All right. This is a twisting vortex of air that goes through a cloud system. But imagine that it's horizontal. All right. So it doesn't, it's not vertical yet. It's a mesocyclone. It's kind of like what a tornado would look like if you put it on its side up in the clouds.
Okay.
All right. And then you get these wind shear, factors, these sharp moving horizontal, winds that can tilt the mesocyclone so that it is upright. And if it does, in fact, go upright and the base of it touches the ground, that's when you get your tornado. And like I said, you can have a very similar set of circumstances that in one case spawn a tornado and in another do not.
Right, right. What helps with the tornado is when you get these inflow bands, which are ragged bands of cumulus clouds, mm-hmm. that extend out away, usually to the south or southeast here in the northern hemisphere. It suggests that the storm is gathering low-level air from several miles away and sucking in that hot, moist air that is going to be fueling the storm.
Right. Now, I've heard another term when it comes to tornadoes, and I wonder if you actually know anything about it, because it intrigues me. It tasks me. and this is the term beaver tail, a beaver's tail. Am I crazy, or is that associated with tornadoes?
No, this is the thing. It's a smooth, flat cloud band that extends, again, in the northern hemisphere from the eastern edge of the storm,
right.
going out to the east or southeast,
uh-huh.
or east or northeast, I'm sorry. It also just suggests the presence of rotation.
Gotcha. Yeah. So in these storm systems, you have areas where there is precipitation and you have areas where there's no precipitation. I think the beaver's tail is in the no precipitation area. So it's kind of one of the borders of these storm systems. So if you see a storm system that has several of these indicators, that's one of those warning signs to say this is the sort of situation in which tornadoes can form.
Right. All of these situations can happen in completely benign, regular old thunderstorms
that
nearly terrify your dog.
Right. Yes.
And wall cloud is another one. That's a cloud that seems like it's descending from the bottom of the storm.
Right.
And those are actually one of the more present. That's like your 10 to 20 minute warning.
Gotcha.
If a tornado is going to form there, you've got about 10 to 20 minutes from when that shows
up.
Wow.
Yeah, that's scary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this tornado is forming, you get an updraft. All right. And that updraft starts to pull in low level air from several miles around. I mean, we're talking a huge system here. And that low level air is pulled up through the updraft from the rain area. And the rain cooled air is incredibly humid, like you were saying. That moisture in the rain-cooled air quickly condenses, and that's where you get that wall cloud, and then you know that the conditions are ripe for a tornado to form. And then you've got the rear flank downdraft, or RFD.
And that's this downward rush of air from the back end of the storm that's descending along with the funnel.
Wow. Yeah, so this looks like it's a bright spot, right? That's what this usually looks like. It's usually to the rear, and in the northern hemisphere, it's the southwest side, which I think actually leads to a wives' tale. There's an old wives' tale that if a tornado's approaching and you have a basement, you should go and huddle in the southwest corner. The idea being that would be the safest way from the path of the tornado. But as it turns out, tornado pathways are not nearly so predictable.
They're very unpredictable, in fact. And also that clear spot just doesn't have rain in it. It's still actually a space of extreme wind activity.
Right. So. And so, then you've got the funnel itself, the visibility of a tornado will often depend upon how much material is in it.
Right.
Usually if it's a little bit of material, that's when it's at its most visible. That's when you can really see the definition of the funnel cloud.
If it's hit some dust or something.
Right. If it's got some debris in there. When it's got a lot, it makes it hard to see because it looks like a mass of darkness coming at you. By the way, we'll probably have some personal stories that we can relate a little bit, because Lauren and I have both experienced being through tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Northeast Georgia.
And I grew up in Ohio.
And both areas have been the site of tornado activity. Granted, not nearly, at least in Northeast Georgia, it's not nearly to the same extent as places in the Midwest that are in what is called Tornado Alley.
Right.
But we still get quite a few.
Yeah. Speaking of Tornado Alley, the United States has, or North America in general, has the most tornadoes of any place on the planet.
Right. Yeah.
About 1,200 per year.
That's a lot.
And this is because of what's called a dry line, which is a center of cool, dry air that is coming off of the deserts to the west mm-hmm. and meeting up with the warm, wet air from the oceans of the east and causing all kinds of havoc.
Right, right. So, you know, a lot of people will say that tornadoes are kind of the result of cold Canadian air mixing with the warm, moist air of the Caribbean. And then the party gets together and the snowbirds come down and the crazy steel drums come up. And then we have a big old party in the form of tornado. And, any storm institute will tell you that's a gross oversimplification.
That's not really that thing.
Tornadoes do occur in other parts of the world.
Absolutely.
I mean, you find them in pretty much everywhere. It's just that the frequency is much greater in the United States.
Sure. After the U.S.
North America, I should say.
Yes. After the U.S., Argentina and Bangladesh have the next two highest proportions mm-hmm. of tornadoes mm-hmm. per year. But yeah, they happen everywhere.
Right. So a lot of the conversation we're going to have is, again, this comes as a surprise to nobody who's been listening to Tech Stuff for a long time, going to be very U.S.-centric, but that kind of makes sense because North America does play home to tornadoes more frequently than anywhere
else. I think we get a pass in this particular instance.
Yeah, trust us. If you live in a place that is very, very infrequently hit by tornadoes, just listen and enjoy as we discuss the terrifying experience that we have gone through as tornadoes have wreaked havoc in our homeland. In fact, we can go ahead and say this. We live in Atlanta right now. And Atlanta a few years ago was hit by a pretty massive tornado that did some major damage in downtown.
It went right through downtown Atlanta,
which is unusual. You don't frequently have tornadoes pass through metropolitan areas. And in fact, there were some theories for a while that the island effect, the heat island effect of cities might have something to do with tornado formation. But, it may just be that it's the odds, you know, just one of those things where it's kind of
cities pretty small.
Yeah.
There's a lot
of
cows.
Yeah. When you're talking about the grand scheme of things, mm-hmm. a city is a tiny target when you talk about the entire United States. But yeah, one went through downtown Atlanta. And there for months, there were major buildings in Atlanta that had temporary covers over a lot of windows, like high rise buildings, skyscraper buildings had these temporary covers on their windows because they had to start replacing all of them. Some of which are in buildings that have very specific types of surfaces. Like we have one hotel in downtown Atlanta that's essentially a cylinder.
A cylinder. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But it does mean that replacing the glass is somewhat difficult.
Yeah.
And there were entire neighborhoods east of downtown that were just laid to waste, including some lofts that had just been built. They had been converted from old warehouses and old manufacturing
factories,
plants.
Yeah.
And they had just been converted into lofts and then destroyed. It's all been rebuilt now, but it can hit major cities. We wanted to talk a bit about the history of storm chasing and just that I've got some about the history of weather forecasting in general, just to kind of get an idea of how we've come to the point where we're at now.
Yeah.
Now, Lauren, the very first date I have is 1849. Do you have anything before that?
1054.
What?
Yes. That was the first, first recorded account of a tornado. It was,
sure is windy out. There goes Johnny.
It was in the village of Rosedala, Ireland.
Oh, sure is windy out. There goes O'Shaughnessy.
And the account said that it looked like a steeple of fire.
Wow. That's poetic. We usually say that there's a tornado. It's coming at us right now. You hear that train coming around the bend? So 1054, do you have anything else before 1849?
No, I do not.
We're in the smarty pants. So in 1849... Professor Joseph Henry of the Smithsonian established a network of weather instruments along telegraph companies. So he partnered with telegraph companies and helped install these weather instruments at their offices in various places around the United States. And he used maps to coordinate between these different telegraph companies. And so the observations they sent back, he would end up making notes on the map. And then from that, he would start to create weather predictions. So that's some of the first weather forecasting in the United States beyond just the, my knee is aching, it's going to rain soon.
Or my dog is freaking out.
Yeah.
That's
so he starts doing this, but there was a little event in the United States that kind of disrupted the whole project. It was called the Civil War. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That kind of ended up taking over the telegraph lines for a while.
Yeah.
For mysterious reasons. In 1865, however, after the conclusion of the Civil War, Professor Henry then suggested that all meteorological observations reorganize under a single agency as a means of predicting storms and warning coastal shipping. So this was the very beginning of developing a national bureau to mm-hmm. oversee this and study it and make forecasts. So 1870 was when the United States formed the Weather Bureau. And that same year, Congress established a National Weather Warning Service under the Secretary of War. Now, this is going to get interesting because this particular office ended up playing hopscotch with the various departments of government. It started off under the Secretary of War, mainly because the military had the most advanced sensors. Well, not really even sensors at this point, but just communication lines.
Right.
So the military was put in charge of this. And also, it was a matter of national security in many cases. So the Secretary of War oversaw this Weather Bureau department, and the Army Signal Corps assumed responsibility for taking observations at military installations and warning people of storms. About 20 years later, in 1890, the Weather Service Organic Act transferred the weather reporting services from the Secretary of War to the Department of Agriculture. It would not be the last time that it would jump ship.
Meanwhile, in 1874, there's a report of John Muir, crazy person, climbing the top of a 100-foot-tall Douglas spruce during a fierce windstorm and writing extensively about how really cool it was.
Storm chaser,
early storm chaser.
Yeah.
Also in 1884, August 28th is the first known photograph of a tornado taken specifically in South Dakota.
Yeah, not from the inside.
No.
In 1896... that was when the first hurricane warning service was established in the United States. And in 1909, the Weather Bureau began a regular program of balloon upper air observations. So this is sort of the beginning of weather balloons. There had been some work with it earlier, but this was the first time that the Bureau itself had started to fund a weather balloon program. And weather balloons are pretty much what they sound like. They are balloons that carry some form of sensor. Whether it's just something to measure wind speed or humidity or barometric pressure or whatever, and then either record it and then you retrieve the balloon and see what the recordings were, or if it has some sort of transmitter.
More modernly, it will transmit back to a computer.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. Or at least a radio station.
Sure.
So you'll get some sort of report back on current atmospheric conditions in the upper atmosphere where, you know, you can't just go outside and say, it's raining. You know, this is more like what are the directions of airflow at higher elevations?
And the temperatures and all of that.
Exactly. In 1928, a Russian meteorologist attached a radio meteorograph to a sounding balloon. Oh, there's some thunder out there. And that was the development of what we consider the modern weather balloon. So the previous weather balloons were kind of early attempts at using balloons to gather more information. But this is when we're actually starting to get information in real time radioed back. Very early on still. And by 1936, that's when the Weather Bureau began operation of weather balloons collecting information such as atmospheric pressure, temperature, humidity, wind direction, and speed. So by 1936, we're starting to get a fairly robust weather reporting system.
Mm-hmm.
In 1940, the Weather Bureau jumps ship again and becomes part of the Department of Commerce. So, once again, playing hopscotch.
Which is where it still is today, I believe.
Yeah. Although it's not the Weather Bureau anymore. We'll talk about that in a second.
Right. Also, circa World War II, we started to see people flying into hurricanes directly to study them.
Yes, we call these crazy people. brave people who really were trying to advance science. They were not doing this, you know, willy-nilly. This was, wow, man, that storm's coming right up on us.
Excellent.
It's heading right for us. It's a tornado. No, it's not. It's just a thunderstorm.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The 1940s is also when Roger Jensen started to become active, and he is one of the people that we refer to as an early storm chaser.
Right. I believe he chased his first storm in 1953 with his father. That's the date that I have.
Oh, yeah? I just have 1940s was when he started, but it's that was a very general kind of answer from the site I was looking at
sure.
the time. So 1953 may be, in fact, more accurate.
Mm-hmm. And Roger Jensen was a turkey processing plant worker and farmer who got deeply involved in the storm, in the growing storm chasing movement. He was, really one of the founders there.
Right. Another one being David Hoadley.
Right.
And you have some information about him, right?
I think he began in 1965.
Gotcha.
Following his first experience there, he just chased storms just all the time.
He was from Falls Church, Virginia.
Yes.
And, he was very much active in that, along with another, scientist, one of the first storm chasing scientists, Neil Ward, again, a very early storm chaser. Meanwhile, while all this storm chasing is starting, and it's just the earliest days of storm chasing, back in 1948, there was an Air Force captain who later became a colonel named Robert Miller and also Major Ernest Fawbush, who were the first on record in the United States to successfully forecast a tornado.
Huh.
They actually forecasted in central Oklahoma. They were observing conditions that were very similar to a tornado that had hit the base 4 days earlier. And they said, these conditions are ripe for another tornado based on all that information. And so they actually began to discuss with the higher ranked members of the base there about whether or not they should take action. Ultimately, they decided that they should prepare for the potential of another tornado. So they acted as if another tornado was going to hit. The next day, another tornado did hit the base. That was two tornadoes that hit the very same base within the span of 5 days, which was, pretty remarkable. I mean, you're talking about, again, a massive area, and for two tornadoes to hit the same place within the span of a week is pretty rare. But that was the first successful forecasting of a tornado on record in the United States. And in 1950, the Weather Bureau revoked a ban on mentioning tornadoes in forecasts. So you might wonder, why was there a ban in place? Why could not weather forecasters say, hey, conditions are ripe for a tornado? Here are the reasons. One, tornadoes at that time in particular were largely mysterious forces that were just kind of considered acts of God, that these were events that would come down, strike with incredible fury.
Things that would, say, incite large spread panic.
Exactly. The thought was that you would do more harm than good by saying, hey, there may be a tornado on the way, because no one knew exactly what they were supposed to do. By 1950, the Weather Bureau had decided that this was no longer a responsible course of action, and that, in fact, it would revoke that ban. By the way, the ban was not always a formal ban. Sometimes it was just highly discouraged from mentioning that conditions were ripe for a tornado. But at this point, they said that that was no longer going to be an official policy. In 1965, you had mentioned that earlier about the storm chasers. That's also the same year when the Weather Bureau changed its there was a reorganization of the Department of Commerce. And so that reorganization ended up creating something called the Environmental Science and Services Administration, or ESSA. And that organization changed the Weather Bureau to the National Weather Service, which will sound a lot more familiar, I think, to many of our listeners. And in 1970, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration formed and replaced ESSA. So that's also known as NOAA, N-O-A-A.
Mm-hmm.
We got to see the headquarters of NOAA.
Yeah.
When we visited Discovery headquarters up in Maryland.
And they're right down the street.
Yeah, we saw NOAA. And then people from NOAA invited us to go and see their stuff and talk to them, which we are totally going to do as soon as we can arrange it.
Yes.
Because that is mega awesome, cool.
Really exciting.
Yeah.
Part of what NOAA was doing in the 1970s was establishing Skywarn, which is a volunteer program that currently, certainly at the time it did not have this many, currently has like 290,000 trained volunteers working across the country in a network to observe and report storms.
Yeah. In 1972, you had the first federally funded storm chasing program, where before we had storm chasers, but they were all acting more or less on their own. They had, you know, no official government backing, at least not from the federal level. And now that had changed. In 1972, you had a federally funded program. Their first sampling of a tornado wouldn't happen until 1973 in Oklahoma, which, as we know, right there in the middle of Tornado Alley. Now, I'm going to skip a whole bunch of years here only to mention one of the most famous programs in storm chasing, which is VORTEX.
Mm-hmm.
Now, VORTEX is an acronym, of course. It stands for Verification of the Origin of Rotation in Tornadoes Experiment. So the EX in VORTEX is from experiment. That was led by Eric Rasmussen of NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory, or NSSL. And hey, I said laboratory instead of laboratory.
You did.
I didn't even have to think about it that time. VORTEX, by the way, was not the only program called that. There was a second one, VORTEX 2, which launched in 2009, but there was an unusually quiet tornado season in 2009, which meant only one tornado was sampled that year. It was sampled in LaGrange, Wyoming, but it was the most intensively observed tornado at that time because there was so much equipment present at that moment. In 2010, VORTEX 2 actually sampled quite a few supercells and a few weak tornadoes as well and gathered a lot of information. Now, during this span of time, there were a lot of other storm chasers that were active.
Right. During the 1970s, David Hoadley founded Storm Track magazine. It was becoming that hobbyist movement that we were talking about a little mm-hmm. bit before. And you know, he was publishing articles in National Geographic and Scientific American. There were programs on the History Channel and ABC. It was becoming very much in the public eye, especially with the creation of these government agencies or the recreation of these government agencies.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Some of these agencies, by the way, you know, we talked about it, you know, the 1860s, there was more than 100 years of information gathered. And it's interesting that it was kind of a, you know, that chain was never broken. It did transform quite a few times.
Sure.
But they remained, like, the information itself remained intact.
And it really wasn't until we started getting, you know, small commercial or small non-commercial vehicles, cars
yeah.
that people could go out and drive around in to respond very quickly to the movement of a storm.
Right.
And furthermore, the, communication technology advancing to the point where through radio and
later.
The beginnings of satellite mm-hmm. and cell phones and et cetera,
yeah,
that we
yeah,
could
yeah.
start to be responsive.
Right, right. In fact, we're going to talk some more about that technology, the stuff that storm chasers use in order to track storms and to measure their impact. We'll also talk about how we classify tornadoes, which is an interesting story all on its own. But before we get into all of that, let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor, Audible. Audible.com is the leading provider of downloadable digital audiobooks and spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded to your iPod or MP3 player. Go to audiblepodcast.com/techstuff to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Since we're talking about storms, here's my recommendation for an Audible book that you can get. In fact, if you sign up and you want that free book, this could be your first one. It's the first in a series. It is called Stormfront, and it's the first book in the Dresden Files series that's written by Jim Butcher. My wife is a huge fan of the series. I am also a fan of the series. It is narrated by James Marsters, who our Buffy fans will recognize as Spike. Anyway, if you are interested in fantasy and sort of a noir feel and detective fiction, I highly recommend it. Check that out. Remember, just go to audiblepodcast.com/techstuff to get that free audiobook download of your choice. All right, so back to tornadoes. Let's talk about how we measure how strong a tornado is. It's actually kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, there's a scale called the Fujita scale.
Yeah, the Fujita-Pearson tornado scale. Originally, in its first format, it ranged from F0 up to, theoretically, F12. F12 would have measured the wind speed at Mach 1, which is the speed of sound.
I don't like that idea.
That's... Yeah, well, most people would say that to really think of the scale in practical terms, you would go from F0 to F6, the idea being that anything over F6 would have probably, we never would see wind speeds at that intensity. Hey, man, don't argue with me, Thunder. I'm just saying what I read.
I really hope that's actually coming through on the mic, because if not, we
really
sound
just crazy.
Particularly
yeah.
silly.
No, it's okay. There really is thunder out there. You might not hear it, but we do. Anyway, so the scale was proposed back in 1971, and it was proposed by Professor Fujita and Alan Pearson, who was the director of the National Severe Storm Forecast Center at that time. And it's kind of a weird scale in a way. It's a scale that determines a tornado's strength based upon the amount of damage it did.
Oh, right. And the problem being that we've never really been very good at measuring how powerful a tornado is at the time, because first of all, they're pretty unpredictable. Second
yeah.
of all, they happen very quickly and end very quickly.
And third of all, they're so powerful that our
most
sensors...
instrumentation gets pretty banged up.
Yeah, it gets janky.
Yeah.
You don't really end up with like a working sensor after a tornado has finished playing with it
mm-hmm.
in many cases. So getting a tornado's wind speed while the tornado is actually active is incredibly difficult. Like you said, Lauren, we don't even know where they're going to form or where they're going to go from and to.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't know what path they'll take. So getting an accurate reading on wind speed while it's happening is really hard to do.
Oh, right. And of course, we can tell how fast they're traveling along the ground, how fast
sure.
the clouds are going
right.
in relation to the ground due to Doppler radar.
Yeah, yeah. We can track a tornado and say, all right, the tornado itself traveled at a speed of 16 miles per hour from west to east. Like,
but of
we
course,
can say that. But
what's going on within it is
yeah,
very different.
Much more mysterious. So, Professor Fujita and Alan Pearson came up with a scale where they would look at the damage that was left after a tornado had passed through and said what speed of wind would be required in order to do this amount of damage. In other words, we were establishing how strong a tornado was after it had already happened by just looking at the devastation that it left. Now, the early scale was not terribly specific and was not really, or maybe I should say not terribly precise. There was an attempt to increase the precision and create the enhanced Fujita-Pearson scale.
That was in 2007.
Yeah. February 1st, 2007 was when it was updated. We call it EF, not just F, So if you ever hear like an F5 tornado, that's really using an outdated format. It's really EF5, what we would say now. And what does that translate to in terms that we mere mortals can understand? Well, first of all, the way they determine the scale is they look at the type of damage that's done and to the type of structures or landscape that it hits. So to really determine it, they look at, you know, if you say that a building was completely demolished, what was the type of building?
Right. You know? How was it built? How sturdy was it in the first place?
Right.
What materials went into making it?
Exactly. And
there's this really complex fact sheet that they have ranked out of different types of buildings.
They've got like 28 or 29 different designations for the type of building or landscape. And then they have
a numerical scale for how much damage was done to each
one. From 1 to 8. Mm-hmm. Right. So 8 being the greatest. So if you had like a concrete steel reinforced building and the devastation was at 8, that was the most unimaginably powerful tornado that could have possibly hit us. And then here's the thing. There's no upper limit to this scale because there may be tornadoes that can destroy the strongest stuff we build. And since we're basing it on devastation, you can't get more devastating than total loss, right?
Right.
So if you have total loss, you essentially say that was a really powerful tornado. You know, you can't get more specific than that because it could be that it's more powerful than our scale would even indicate. But after you've lost everything, it's kind of a moot point.
Oh, right, right. Which is basically what they're saying with a EF5 would be wind speeds over 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You're
getting to a point where strong frame houses could be lifted into the air and carried a considerable distance before it was dropped again.
To Oz, for example.
Yeah, yeah. So EF0 would be the lowest. That's between 65 and 85 miles per hour winds. Then at EF1, it would be 86 to 110 miles per hour.
2 goes up to 135 miles per hour. 3 goes up to 165.
4 goes up to 200.
And then anything over that,
is EF5. Now, in the old scale, you had up to F6, really, was what was being described. And under that old scale, an F6 tornado was called an inconceivable tornado.
Was it for reals?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I don't think that tornado means what you think it means. But at that point, they said that the wind speeds were unlikely to happen at that intensity. That was described as 319 to 379 miles per hour.
I think the highest on record is 318, isn't it? I believe.
Yeah, which is why 319 would be the F6. Mm-hmm. And that the idea here was that you might not even be able to tell that it was an F6 tornado because anything from F5 would leave essentially total devastation in its wake. Right.
So what's the difference between total devastation
and more total devastation? They said that essentially you would have to verify it by looking at the evidence of the ground swirl pattern left behind.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. So the point being that it's about the best we can do simply because, again, it's really hard to get a read on a tornado while it's happening. We really can only look at what happened afterward and say, well, based upon this, we deduce the tornado was X strong.
Right.
You know? So with that in mind, what is the kind of gear that we use for storm chasing and measuring this kind of stuff? I mean, you've got your basic weather sensors, things like a barometer, which reads barometric pressure. In general, tornadoes form after a drop in air pressure, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a sudden drop followed by a tornado. The drop can actually happen several days before a tornado forms if there's a low pressure system moving in on a broad scale. So it's also very difficult to measure barometric pressure within a tornado because the instruments very rarely survive. However, we will talk about someone who did manage to do that. That'll be toward the end of our podcast. Then there's the anemometer. Man.
Right. There's blade and anemometers anemometers and sonic
I had to steady myself to say anemometer.
You did, and you took a gust of relief afterwards. The analog blade ones are if you've ever seen a like a spoked series of arms or cups perched atop a
building
cylinder,
It's designed to measure wind speed. So if you've ever seen one of those things, it looks like it's a little pinwheel type thing, sometimes horizontally aligned with the little cups at the end of the arms. It's spinning around in a circle, This does not tell us anything about wind direction, but it does tell us about wind speed. Essentially, you're talking about how quickly is this thing spinning, and from that we can derive how fast the wind is blowing.
Right.
It only really works if the wind is blowing in a steady direction. If it starts blowing in various directions, it can really mess with the readings. But, that's how we kind of determine wind speed. Of course, thermometers tell us things about temperature, and we can learn about humidity through various means. So getting to the basic gears of storm chasers, a lot of the basic gear is the kind of stuff that you might have at your disposal already. Things like laptop computers.
With Wi-Fi. Digital cameras.
Yeah, video cameras that are both for video or for still photography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Radios, walkie-talkies, ham, CB, anything that they can get their hands on.
Yeah, police scanners, that kind of stuff. Stuff that allows them to keep track of the movement of weather systems. Anything that will give them the most up-to-date
data.
By
immediate communication with anyone who is providing information about that storm.
Right. And then, the video cameras are obviously there to document the actual storms, to watch their behavior, to take footage, possibly to sell that footage later on, or maybe it's just so that you can use it for research purposes.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a combination of the two.
Journalistic
purposes, mm-hmm. obviously. Yeah. And so those are your basic pieces of equipment. There's some interesting approaches to studying tornadoes, some of which are not necessarily used that frequently today. Did you run into the term tornado photogrammetry?
I did not.
Photogrammetry is an older form. We don't tend to use it as much because it's not terribly precise. But it's the use of film or video to determine the speed of movement of some kind of tracer element. So you take a tracer element as a point of reference. This is not necessarily something that you've introduced to the tornado. It may be something that the tornado has already picked up, like, I don't know, a tractor. And it's usually a large piece of debris or some sort of persistent element in the cloud itself. And from this, you can start to infer what the wind speed is, with varying and sometimes unknown reliability. So you analyze how the wind speed is by measuring the movement of this persistent element. How frequently is it coming around over and over? And from that, you can sit there and say, well, the wind speed appears to be this. It was used more in the 1970s and the 1980s, but we kind of replaced this with something that's far more reliable, namely Doppler radar. In fact, we have Doppler radar that's mobile. It's called Doppler on Wheels.
Or DOW, DOW.
DOW. And Doppler on Wheels, those are the main tools used in the effort to determine the strength of tornado winds today. So that raises the question, what is Doppler radar and how does that work?
Well, the Doppler effect we have talked about on the show before, but it is the effect of electromagnetic waves
mm-hmm.
crunching up as something moves towards you.
Right, right. It's same thing with sound, right? So it's any kind of wave. If it's moving toward you, the frequency of the wave increases because the object is actually moving toward you. If it's moving away, the frequency decreases. Those waves elongate. So in sound, and for once, it's amazing that we can't hear it, because whenever we record tech stuff, there seems to always be sirens going off in the background. But with sound, like if a police car has its siren running and it's coming toward you, you might hear a higher pitch. And then after it passes you, it goes to a lower pitch. That's an example of the Doppler effect with sound waves. Same thing is true with electromagnetic waves. And radar uses electromagnetic waves to kind of get an idea of where other objects are.
It uses radio waves, right?
Yep.
It will shoot a very quick, like millisecond burst of radio waves.
Yeah, called a pulse.
Called a pulse out, hopefully towards an object.
Yep.
Or sometimes, just to see what's out there.
Yeah.
And then it will measure the length of time between when it's sent and when an echo comes back.
Right.
And will also measure the Doppler effect.
Right.
Of
the phase, the mm-hmm. phase of that wave. So between the phase of the wave and how long it took for the wave to return back from the echo of the wave to return back, it can determine the location and whether or not something's moving toward it or away from it.
And a vague concept of how fast by kind of mathematically computing.
Yeah,
the two
together. If you measure between pulses, you start to get an idea. Oh, well, not only is it moving toward me, but it's moving toward me at this general speed. So, Doppler on wheels, of course, very useful because that means you can move the the radar around so that you can get a better idea of the speed of the storm itself, mm-hmm. and even get an idea of the strength of the tornado.
Right. However, these vehicles have to stay between 2 and 8 miles away from a tornado to be effective.
Right. And it's mostly effective if it's encountering stuff that is fairly large in the relative scheme of things. So in other words, if there's precipitation, that's great. That means that there's more stuff for the radar waves to bounce off of. And that could be, if it's larger raindrops, that's even better. If it's hailstones, that's fantastic because that gets a lot more radar.
For the Doppler.
Doppler. For anyone who's caught underneath it, hailstones are terrible. You do not want to be under them. But for the purposes of radar, it works really, really well. And I think the strongest wind speed determined from a Dow is, at least from the data I was able to find, keep in mind some of this data is several years old because a lot of it comes from government sources and reports can take a while to compile and publish, become publicly available. But the strongest I was able to find was 302 miles per hour. So
I saw a report of one from Oklahoma in 1999 that recorded the world record speed of 318.
Oh, okay. So. Gotcha. Yeah, my latest records are later than your latest records.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's a specific type of radar that has been used for some storm tracking technology. It's called a SMART-R, which is, again, yet another acronym. Stands for Shared Mobile Atmospheric Research and Teaching Radar. This is one that is mainly used for research. It's used both for hurricanes and for tornadoes. And this combination of technology is used to really get as much information about strength and speed as we possibly can so that we can add to our body of knowledge. And then there's some private chase teams and tours that have marine radars mounted on their vehicles. However, you should know, this is decoration. Marine radars are useless when it comes to storm chasing and storm tracking. It's promotional purposes only.
Wow.
They're not used in research. And actually, marine radar signals can interfere with research units like Dows. So don't do it. storm chasing companies, don't put marine radar on your trucks and then use them.
Yeah, that's pretty silly. There are some projects that have been very interesting, but not very successful.
Right.
TOTO is one of my favorites. TOTO standing for Totable Tornado Observatory.
Now, TOTO, of course, is also obviously a reference to
the Wizard of Oz.
That fantastic documentary about a tourist from Kansas who visits an exotic land and kills one of the leaders of that land. Two of them, actually.
TOTO was developed by Dr. Alan Bedard and Carl Ramsey in 1979, first deployed by them in 1981. And basically, it was an oil drum, like a 55-gallon oil drum with some stuff in it.
Gotcha.
With some instruments in it.
The idea that a tornado would pick this drum up and we would gather the information from the instruments inside, and hopefully the drum would protect the instruments so that the information would be usable.
Right.
So how'd that work out?
Well, it weighed 400 pounds, which is 181 kilograms or so, and so not actually very well. I mean, first of all, you know, they were working in the early 1980s when we did not have the kind of communication technology that would allow people to really effectively chase storms.
Right.
So
right.
It was pretty much a crapshoot of whether or not they would leave this thing in a place that would
be likely to get picked up.
Right.
Yeah, keep in mind, they don't have the benefit of a laptop with Wi-Fi in 1981. So they have
or
the
even
latest.
A cell phone.
Yeah. Radio, they could have radio.
Yes.
So they could get radio updates, but without the ability to actually track a storm on a computer and see it and be able to anticipate where it's going to move, it made it much more difficult to get to the right place at the right time.
Sure. Also, it took 30 seconds to deploy from the back of a specially created truck. Which sounds like a short period of time, but that is tremendously long when a tornado is bearing down on you.
Yeah, or if you're anticipating a tornado. Keep in mind, we were talking about that wall cloud, which was the indicator that a tornado could touch down within 10 to 20 minutes. If it takes you half an hour to unpack your equipment, just finding out where the tornado might touch down and then getting the equipment out and set on the ground, first of all, it may be too late. It may
sure.
be that the tornado has touched down while you were trying to get your equipment out, in which case you may be in serious danger. Or conditions could have changed to the point where the place where you thought was the perfect spot is no longer anywhere close to where the tornado may touch down.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very difficult. As a surprise to no one, it was never really picked up by a tornado.
No, it did. A tornado did run over it once in 1985, when the NSSL had taken over
mm-hmm.
for it, and mostly the tornado just knocked it over and damaged the instruments.
Yeah, so it served as inspiration for another fictional device.
Did it?
Yes, it did. TOTO was the inspiration for Dorothy, which was the fictional device in the
Twister.
Film Twister. Yeah, so the movie that made us believe that a cow could be picked up by a tornado and still be perfectly cow-like.
Willing to moo, at any rate.
Yeah, and not turned into hamburger. It was Dorothy was the name of the device they wanted to deploy in the film and try and get it in the path of the tornado. It was inspired by the real world analog TOTO.
In reality, TOTO was scrapped in 1987.
Yeah.
However, there are many other instruments that have been created for similar purposes. One is called a turtle.
Yeah.
Which
this is,
are kind of hubcap looking little devices that are, they were debuted, I believe, in 1986 and, were on that beginning edge of digital technology.
Yeah, they were not meant to be picked up. They were actually designed as heavy, squat, and aerodynamic. The idea being that they could withstand the wind forces of a tornado so that you could retrieve them and find out all the information you needed, things like temperature, pressure, humidity, and not just get picked up like TOTO was. It was just meant to be there so that you could recover it afterward the tornado had passed through.
There are also snails, which are similar in appearance, but are outfitted with these seismic sensors.
Okay.
Because there was a theory at some point that if we can study the vibrations that tornadoes create in the ground, that we would be able to learn new fun stuff about them.
Huh. Interesting. I had not heard about that.
Also, Dillocams and Observation Zero, OZs, OZs,
Okay.
I just got that. I'm
so
sorry.
So Dorothy, Toto, and Oz.
Right. Which are camera equipment that has been designed to be put in the place of
I totally forgot to write it down. There's also munchkins, because as it turns out, storm chasers get hungry and occasionally stop at Dunkin' Donuts and they just order a bunch of those to eat while they're waiting. I just figured that we might as well keep on going down this Wizard of Oz route.
So what about armored vehicles?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So you're talking about the TIV.
Yes.
The Tornado Intercept Vehicle. There's actually been a couple of these. And in fact, Tornado Intercept Vehicle is kind of a generic name at this point. You're really talking about any kind of reinforced vehicle, but specifically, we're talking about essentially, you take a pretty heavy vehicle, one that's already pretty rugged, and then you turn it into a reinforced, possibly armor-plated, possibly augmented vehicle.
Something that looks like it came out of Mad Max.
Yeah, yeah. You might be wondering, you know, who rules Bartertown by the time you see one of these things. They are meant to withstand high wind speeds, hail, massive trauma. They're reinforced, and sometimes they have hydraulic panels that can actually extend down to the sides of the vehicle. The idea being that if you extend the hydraulic panel so that it goes from the ground and leaves no space under the vehicle, then you can't have wind sweep in underneath the vehicle and lift it off or push it off its perch.
Right. So some of them even have stabilizing jacks that will
extend down and
into the ground
and stabilize mm-hmm. this so that when heavy wind hits it, it doesn't rock over and tilt over and fall off.
Right. The TIV 2 specifically was one that was created that weighed about 8 tons.
Yeah, that's a pretty hefty vehicle. It also usually has windows designed so that someone with a camera can get as many different angles as possible.
The original was created by one Sean Casey, who is an IMAX cinematographer.
Yeah.
Who is working towards some documentary pieces.
I remember seeing bits from that. I never got to see the full. I assume they eventually had probably more than one documentary based on this. But I do remember seeing excerpts of this, and they were pretty fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I also remember seeing at least one clip where the crew was concerned that his desire to get the best footage was possibly a little reckless. That's probably the best way for me to put it.
I have no doubt that could be a thing that could have happened.
Well, what kind of information have storm chasers gathered? Mainly we're talking about atmospheric conditions, things like the rotation of the clouds, getting more information about that, more information about the actual sequence of events that leads up to tornado formation, the behavior of the tornadoes themselves, the strength of the tornado, we've got some information about barometric pressure, some things about temperature, wind speeds and all this kind of stuff, humidity. It's really just trying to get as much data as possible and sift through it to learn what is it that really makes these things happen.
Oh, right, because some of the leading theories for a long time had a lot to do with temperature differences.
Mm-hmm.
Right up until we got some data in from tornadoes that said that temperature differences in airflow do not have to exist for a tornado to be created.
Right, doesn't have. That's not a necessary factor.
Right, and so you know it's kind of one of those things where the more we learn, the more we realize that we have to learn, and it is so difficult to get good readings.
And
so dangerous.
We're talking about such huge forces here that getting a good reading is just it's risky, and a lot of the stuff we've developed just can't hold up to those kind of forces.
Mm-hmm. It can, as we said, be very financially viable. One Warren Fadley is a kind of rock star storm chaser whose photos of storms can sell for over $10,000 a piece.
Yeah, yeah. Which has inspired a lot of people to try and follow in his footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one of the big controversies. And we can go ahead and move into the controversy of storm chasing. One of them is that with documentaries, with reality television, I mean, we do have storm chasers on Discovery. We've got
It was ended in 2011.
Yeah. So, but there's been some controversy that these sort of things have inspired lots and lots of people to either pursue it as a hobby or go into the tourism trade, that sort of stuff. And that in itself can add to the already significant danger of storm chasing for research purposes or even as a profession.
Especially considering the fact that if you've got, if you do have research professionals who are out there trying to be safe and you get in their way, that's bad times for everybody.
You can cause traffic jams right when people need to have an open escape route in case the storm changes dramatically. And that can happen. Storms can travel in one direction and then suddenly veer off. And you need to be nimble enough to be able to respond to that. But if you've got a line of cars behind you and that's the only way out, then you're kind of stuck. It also means adding the danger of first responders needing to get to locations after a tornado has passed through. So it's one of those things that has raised some concerns because, legally speaking, there are no rules or laws regarding storm chasing apart from obeying traffic laws and things like trespassing. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly you are not supposed to trespass on people's property. You aren't supposed to, drive the wrong way down the street, that kind of stuff. But beyond that, there's not really anything, there's nothing illegal about storm chasing, but there have been some discussions about that. And in 2013, we had a tragedy in which three storm chasers, famous ones, Tim Samaras, Paul Samaras, his son, and Carl Jung, they died in an accident. They were caught in a tornado near El Reno, Oklahoma.
This was on May 31st, and they had been part of the Discovery Show Storm
right.
Chasers.
Now,
full disclosure. We are HowStuffWorks is a
part
daughter
of
company of Discovery.
Now we should also say that they were experienced storm chasers, and they were widely regarded as responsible members of the community, and they had provided quite a bit of scientific research.
Absolutely. Tim, in fact, founded TWSTX, which is similar to VORTEX. It's an acronym for the Tactical Weather Instrumented Sampling in Tornadoes Experiment.
Yeah. He had an engineering background, and he successfully deployed a turtle that recorded the barometric pressure of two different tornadoes. One in 2003 recorded a barometric drop in pressure of 40 millibars. And another probe recorded a 100 millibar drop in a violent tornado in South Dakota. Later on, other turtles would record more barometric pressure, but his was the first one to do that.
Wow.
So he was really contributing to the scientific knowledge of tornadoes. And so their deaths were very tragic, obviously, and also raised up a conversation about, is storm chasing something
responsible? Is it okay?
Should we be
looking for other things for non-human endangering ways to collect this data?
And it's one of those things again where there's not been any official movement as far as I'm aware, but people like the Kansas Emergency Management Association president Brian Stone said it was worth looking into establishing at least some rules to guide storm chasers, if not formal laws, at least kind of a code, really, that storm chasers need to follow. Now, keep in mind, Tim Samaras and his crew were experts. I mean, they were known for being very safety conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So this really shows how unpredictable these storms can be.
Right.
And that even if you are at the top of your game and you are very careful, tragedy can strike.
Yeah. Supposedly, the storm that they were killed in killed another 10 people out in Oklahoma and supposedly had one of those very quick turns
right.
that no one could have predicted that probably blocked their escape route.
And
so
the National Weather Service does not endorse storm chasing because of the risk involved. However, they do welcome the reports that storm chasers bring in. So it's kind of, it's one of those things where they say, yeah, we can't say go out and be a storm chaser, but we will say that the data we get is
invaluable.
Yes, we can't put a price tag on that because it's helping us understand these systems, and that's really the best way we know of doing it.
And through Skywarn, in fact, they will conduct spotter training classes across the United States. If you are very interested in storm chasing, I would recommend not probably going on one of the tours. I don't think they're necessarily responsible, but
right.
You
can't, some may be very good at following safety rules and some may be a little more lax in that. It's hard to say.
It's hard to say, but Skywarn will train you up teach you how to
yes.
do it.
You can do it. You can do this in the most responsible and safe way possible, which is that's the best thing. I mean, this is your passion and this is you want to contribute to the scientific knowledge. I mean, I find that admirable. I personally also think it's crazy because like I said, Lauren and I could talk a little bit about our experience living through tornadoes. And I would never, ever, ever want to invite that experience on me again if I can avoid it.
What did happen?
Okay. All right. Well, I can talk about that. So I grew up in Northeast Georgia near a city called Gainesville, which actually has a history of tornado problems. There was a tornado that moved through early in the 20th century and laid the city to waste. I mean, it completely destroyed Gainesville. My grandfather worked in a textile mill in New Holland, Georgia, which is just outside of Gainesville. And he told the story. He's passed on now, but he told a story about how working in the mill, the tornado was bearing down on the mill and he was moving toward the staircase to get down to a safe level. And as he was hitting the staircase, the roof of the building ripped off because of this tornado, the force of this wind. And, this was the same tornado that essentially leveled the city. Now, when I was growing up, we had several tornadoes pass over the area of town I lived in, which is called Oakwood, Georgia. I grew up there, and I can remember, like, there were houses that were within just a very short walk. Like, you just walked up a hill and you could see them that were completely leveled by tornadoes on a couple of occasions. And, I mean, I remember huddling with my family at the base of our house, not even sure if our house was going to be hit by these things. And we had tornadoes pass directly over us where, you know, sometimes a tornado will touch down and then lift up and touch down again. In fact, there's even argument about whether or not that counts as two separate tornadoes
or
the same one.
Sure.
We've had that happen where a tornado went directly over our house where it lifted up and then set back down a little bit further out. So, as a kid, that was a life defining experience to the point where I had trouble with storms for a while after that. These days, storms don't bother me so much. I can handle that just fine. But if it starts turning like ominous, if I start noticing those little warning signs, I take cover because it is serious business. I mean, it is absolutely terrifying to live through.
Sure. My experience is a lot more spotty than that. I remember being maybe about 5 years old and my mother and, our extremely dedicated, black Labrador retriever, herding me down into the basement. And, but I think that mostly by the time we got there, like by the time we heard about it and got down there, the radio was already calling it off. So,
wow. Yeah.
And this is the two types of warnings that you may have heard of and had a tiny bit of confusion about, because I don't feel like they're very well publicized, the differences between them all the time. A tornado watch is issued by the, NOAA, Storm Prediction Center meteorologists, and they are watching the, entire United States all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A tornado warning, however, is issued by a local NOAA, National Weather Service Forecast Office, who is watching your designated area all the time. And the warning indicates that there are spotters who have seen a touchdown and that you need to get to safety.
Right.
The watch is more that there are conditions that are favorable for that, a tornado.
A tornado could form under such conditions.
Right.
Yeah, I've seen so many of both. It's one of the risks of living in the Southeast United States. Not nearly as prone to tornadoes as other parts of the nation, which can get them even more regularly than we do. And I thought I'd close out. This is something that another storm chaser had said about, the situation with Tim Samaras and his son Paul and Carl Jung. His name is Rennie Vandewedge. And I apologize if I have butchered that name, but he had this to say, and I thought it was interesting. There's actually quite a bit that he has written about the storm chasing in general, but I thought this really bears attention in our podcast. So he said, many storm chasers do a lot of good. Some are researchers trying to understand why some storms produce tornadoes and others do not. Tim Samaras, for example, combined his background in engineering and weather to invent devices for measuring conditions inside a tornado. His research has been valuable. Other researchers use mobile radar units to measure precipitation and wind inside a tornado from close range to gain a better understanding of how tornadoes develop. Other chasers are simply out there for the thrill of chasing or to capture video to sell to media outlets. But as tornado video has become plentiful on YouTube and other websites, chasers have had to get closer than ever to get the kind of footage that will earn them a paycheck. They often find themselves in the bear's cage, which is chaser lingo for the part of the storm where a tornado forms. Some have built vehicles to drive directly into a twister. This carries enormous risk. Now, he teaches meteorology and brings students with him on trips where they observe these storm fronts and the weather conditions so that the meteorologists have direct experience with this before they go on to whatever their careers are. But I thought it was really interesting to have a professional opinion added in there because, of course, like we said at the very top of the show, this is, and we've repeated several times, this is serious, dangerous business. It's not something for just a casual attempt. You know, you definitely want experienced people around you. If you are interested in the field, that's amazing. But definitely seek out training and make sure that you're following as many safety procedures as you can, because this is deadly stuff. But that kind of wraps up this discussion. It's kind of heavy in times, and obviously, you know, we've had our own personal experiences that kind of give us our own perspective on that.
Color, sure.
But it is a fascinating thing. I mean, this is part of the adventurous spirit of human beings, and the fact that there are people who are willing to put themselves at risk in order to gain more information.
And also get the knowledge out there about any storms that are developing.
Yeah.
So that people can get to safety.
It's one of the reasons why I think humankind is such an amazing, amazing species. I mean, we're willing to do this sort of stuff for various motivations, but the fact that we are is just phenomenal. So guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Stuff. If you have any suggestions for future topics or you want to comment, maybe you've lived through a tornado and you want to tell us your story, please do share that story with us. You can email us. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or you can drop us a line on our social media, Facebook and Twitter. You can find us with the handle TechStuffHSW, and Lauren and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network.